of Australia, coming behind Julian Assange and then weighing in with President Biden each time he met with him, Anthony, and what Julian Assange means in Australia.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Amy and Juan. Look, the release of Julian is a big story here for obvious reasons. I think a lot of Australians for years have felt incredibly angry with the fact that an Australian citizen, Julian Assange, is being prosecuted in the US under the Espionage Act. He's not an American citizen. He's barely spent any time in America. And I think it goes to the heart of how many Australians feel about the relationship between the US and Australia. Often Australians feel like we're, and I agree with this, a client state of the US. This is because of joining every single war in the Middle East, wars in Vietnam. We have a massive US intelligence base, Pine Gap, in the centre of Australia. Australia really is not an independent nation. And the idea of the US prosecuting Julian for journalism, which was, as Trevor rightly says, what so many decent journalists do every day, speaking to sources inside government and elsewhere, was an outrage. And I think for many years, a lot of Australians, the majority, in fact, of Australians wanted him to come home. I'm obviously glad that the current government has done that, mostly behind the scenes. I mean, for many, many years, the former government, much more conservative one, had no interest in trying to get Julian Assange home. And I think it just goes to the heart also, because I've been knowing WikiLeaks since 2006 when they first launched, started to get to know Julian then from the beginning when he launched it in Melbourne, Australia. And really from the beginning, his whole idea was that so much of mainstream journalism was too close to those in power. And as anyone who is a journalist or a citizen or anyone interested in accountability, there's really no media organization in my adult life that has released more vital documents about the state of global power than WikiLeaks, from Guantanamo to Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, the drug war. So many documents which you can access free on their website. And I think that goes to the heart why many Australians, in fact, felt very proud, because in some ways in the last decades, there are two major global figures of media interest from Australia, Rupert Murdoch, who's obviously very, very right wing, and Julian Assange, who obviously is a very, very different person. So there's elation in Australia today, and rightly so.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you that about that, Anthony, the impact of Julian and WikiLeaks on the practice of modern journalism. It seems to me that it has not been the same since WikiLeaks first came on the scene. And if you could speculate about the impact that he has had on this on the practice of reporting.
Well, it's been profound. And obviously WikiLeaks started really before social media took off. I mean, 2006, there was Facebook, but it was in its infancy. And really now every major media organization has a so-called Dropbox where sources can deliver information. I think there is a much greater awareness in at least some aspects of the mainstream press. So there needs to be more accountability and transparency around their actions. I think that's not as much as there should be, to be clear. And I think also what it's done, it really ties into a larger picture of how many people in the world, really, in the global south or the north, increasingly do not trust those in the mainstream press for not reporting the reality of what's going on, whether it's the war in Palestine, whether it's the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in the last 20 years, the war on terror, Guantanamo, torture. And I think a lot of people in the public demand much more accountability from the mainstream press, but they're not getting it. And if you look at pretty much any public opinion poll of the mainstream press by the public, there is deep contempt for a lot of us in our profession. Not all, of course, not all, but many in the mainstream press are not treated with respect. And I think WikiLeaks, in some ways, the documents that they have released over years now, close to 20 years, I think often has shown up the mainstream press, which I think is why so many journalists still to this day, there have obviously been many reporters who have supported Julian over the years, to be sure. But I think a lot of journalists have been jealous. I think there's a lot of professional jealousy around what WikiLeaks has achieved in its life. And obviously what happens now is up to Julian and WikiLeaks as an organization. Who knows where it will go? But I think the legacy is very clear, and the documents that they have released, even if they release nothing else beyond this date, their legacy is set because of the vital documents that they've put into the public domain.
I want to, Anthony, go to the collateral murder video shot in July 2007, leaked by Chelsea Manning to WikiLeaks. The now infamous video showed U.S. forces killing 12 people, including two Reuters employees, Saeed Shema and Namir Nur Eldin, an up-and-coming videographer in Iraq. They were killed when they were opened fire on by an Apache helicopter.
Let me know when you get it. Watch you. Light them all up.
302 traffic, 260.
Come on, fire. Hey, Roger. Keep shooting. Keep shooting.
Bushmaster 26, Bushmaster 26. We need to move time now.
All right, we just engaged all eight individuals.
Reuters driver, 40-year-old Saeed Shema, father of four, survived the initial attack. He's seen trying to crawl away as the helicopter flies overhead. And this is footage, by the way, taken by the Apache helicopter. U.S. forces open fire again when they notice a van pulling up to evacuate the wounded Saeed Shema.
Bodies.
Where's that van at?
Right down there by the body.
Okay, yeah.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse, we have individuals going to the scene. Looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
Let me engage.
Hey, we need to stop that so we can get down there.
Can I shoot?
Roger. Break. Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage.
I'm picking up the wounded. Yeah, we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
You're taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
This is Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV, or bongo truck, picking up the box. Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on.
Clear. Clear.
Orange.
Coming around, clear.
Roger. Trying to,
Clear.
Roger, I lost him in the
jungle. I got him. Should have a van in the middle of the road with about 12 to 15 bodies.
Oh yeah, look at that, right through the windshield.
That last ha. In the van, it was a father who was driving his two children to school, and he had stopped to help the Reuters employee. Reuters had applied for years to try to get a hold of the video that showed the killing of their two workers, the videographer, Namir Nur Eldin and Saeed Shema. They couldn't get it. It was only when WikiLeaks released it that the world saw. It's called, by WikiLeaks, the collateral murder video, again shot in July 2007, leaked by Chelsea Manning to WikiLeaks. And I want to go from this video, Anthony, and the significance of this, that video shot in 2007, coming as a new report by 972 magazine in Israel is just out. It's headlined, How Israeli Drone Strikes Are Killing Journalists in Gaza. It reports survivor testimonies and audiovisual analysis reveal a pattern of strikes by Israeli UAVs on Palestinian journalists in recent months, even when they're clearly identifiable as press. So you've covered WikiLeaks, you've talked about their work in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you have written extensively about Gaza. Can you talk about that, this latest report?
Well, one so shocking, really, since October 7 is that there's more journalists killed by Israel and Gaza than any conflict in decades. In fact, I think pretty much any time in recorded history in the last 30 years. And that way, I think, goes to the heart of how Israel views Palestinian journalists. They actually don't view them as journalists. They don't view them as people who deserve protection, regardless of the vests, regardless of what work they're doing. They see them as akin to terrorists. And that's clear based on that recent reporting you just mentioned, Amy, but also various other reports, including journalists that I've spoken to in Gaza in the last months and journalists I've spent time with in Gaza in the last 15 years, that Israel regards really so many Palestinians as legitimate targets. You don't kill, as Israel has, 40 to 50,000 Palestinians, the vast majority of whom are civilians, if you don't regard mass slaughter as the point. That is the point. The point is to kill not every single Palestinian in Gaza, but to kill huge amounts of Palestinians, including journalists, reporters. And it's interesting how since October 7, as we know, not one foreign journalist has entered Gaza. In fact, one has been there very briefly from CNN. But aside from her, no one has. And Palestinian journalists have been our eyes and ears, even though the death toll is unprecedented. And yet, despite that, there is still a sense of many in the Western elite and, frankly, Western press still not regarding Israel akin to, say, Russia. Russia is easily regarded as a rogue state because of its actions in, say, Ukraine. And yet somehow when we talk about Israel, who, by the way, has killed more journalists in Gaza than Russia's ever killed in Ukraine, somehow we treat Israel differently in some circles. The US certainly does, much of Europe certainly does, my country, Australia, does. So I think that kind of complete unaccountability within Israel is something that is going to haunt it for many years to come. There'll be court cases, and many Israeli leaders are going to find that they will not be able to go to certain countries because of possible prosecution or worse. And that's welcome. And WikiLeaks, I think, has shown in some ways a model of how there needs to be accountability and protection of journalists, because we are at a period in history now where journalists are under more threat than really ever before. Obviously, Gaza is the obvious example, but elsewhere, Ukraine, Sudan, Congo, and elsewhere.
And Anthony, along that vein, I wanted to ask you about the hypocrisy of the press in the United States and in the West in general, that many of these media outlets are using footage from Gaza that these Palestinian journalists are largely almost totally producing, and yet they're remaining silent about the killing of journalists by the Israelis.
And that really goes to the heart of so much of the American press. I mean, I was thinking in the last month, this White House correspondence dinner, this kind of joke of journalists getting together, palling around with Joe Biden. They talk about the importance of press freedom. What they did not talk about at that dinner a few months ago were two key things: WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, who obviously was still in Belmarsh then in London, and journalists in Gaza who are being slaughtered on massive scale by Israel. I mean, the idea that an American media outlet would not give the same kind of credit or presence of Gazan journalists, Palestinian journalists, to others in other countries, it really speaks, I think, to the heart of, I think there is still this real contempt and, frankly, racism at the heart of many in the American press. That not all, of course, obviously, but in many circles, there is still this unwillingness to actually recognize not just Palestinians as human beings, Palestinians as deserving protection, but Palestinian journalists demanding accountability. I mean, where is the New York Times or the Washington Post or all these other outlets? As you say, Juan, without these Palestinian journalists, we would not have any vision in Gaza. There are no Western journalists in Gaza, and yet we rely on Palestinian journalists who have been beyond heroic in the last 8+ months. And I think it really goes to the heart of how so many people, particularly younger Americans and younger people generally, regard so many people in the mainstream press with contempt. That's why they're getting their information often, not from the New York Times, the Washington Post, they're getting them from social media or elsewhere, which is why I think so many young people view what's happening in Gaza and the genocide going on there as generationally defining. This is not something Israel can come back from.
Anthony Lowenstein, we want to thank you for being with us from Sydney, Australia, independent journalist, longtime supporter of WikiLeaks, and author of a critical book on Palestine. The book is called The Palestine Laboratory. We're also joined by Trevor Timm. Thank you, Trevor, for being with us, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. But we're going to end with the words of Julian Assange. A decade ago, 2014, I went inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian Assange had taken political asylum, to interview him. He'd been holed up there for more than 2 years at that point, having received political asylum from the government of Ecuador, but could not make it to Ecuador without being arrested. Toward the end of our interview, I asked Julian Assange, what gives you hope and what do you see as the greatest legacy of WikiLeaks? This was Julian's response.
Well, hopefully the greatest legacy is still to come, but WikiLeaks started in 2007, but it was really this very public confrontation that we had in 2010, 2011, which people saw watching. So it was not... A new generation saw history unfolding in real time before their eyes, a history that they were part of. Young people see the internet as their place, where they exchange ideas and culture and so on. And previously they had been politically apathetic because they didn't feel that they could be a part of the power process. But seeing Hillary Clinton's personal cables and equivalents from many different countries and the fight that we were in and being part of that in some way by spreading this information or talking about it with others educated a new generation. And the internet went from being a politically apathetic space to being a political space. And that then spread into many different things. And so I think this is actually the most significant thing that we have done. We have also, in terms of the publishing industry, widened the envelope of what is acceptable to publish and so on. That's been quite important and set off a cascade of examples which are going through allegedly Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden and Jeremy Hammond and many others to come forward and reveal abuses in government.
Is there another Edward Snowden in the pipeline?
I'm sure there will be. In fact, I'm sure there already is.
So that's Julian Assange a decade ago in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He would then be taken by the British police to Belmarsh prison. He has just been released from there after 5 years. Soon we will be broadcasting Julian Assange speaking for himself in his own words, either in Saipan, where he'll go to a U.S. district court and plead guilty to one felony, and then head home to Sydney, Australia, to rejoin his family. When we come back, low-income advocates are joining climate activists here in New York to demand Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul reverse her shocking decision to cancel the city's congestion pricing program that was just set to start. We'll be back in 20 seconds.
Watch you drinking rum or whiskey. Now won't you have a double with me? I'm sorry I'm a little late. I got your message, by the way. I'm calling in sick today.
Forget You by Noisettes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This week, as much of New York City is under an air quality alert, activists are demanding Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul reverse her shocking decision to cancel New York's congestion pricing plan weeks before it was set to start. Hochul abruptly halted the plan she'd long advocated for, which would have charged cars and trucks a fee between $15 and $36 to enter Manhattan. The governor defended her decision Sunday on MSNBC.
What are we doing to our residents, our citizens? We're hearing their cries for relief, putting on an additional cost of $15 at this moment when people are going to the grocery stores and they're shocked how much less they can buy with the same amount of money week after week. They just received word in New York City their water rates are going up. The rent stabilization board just went up. So how much can we do in state government to relieve the burden and the pain that our citizens are feeling? We cannot be tone deaf to them at this time. But my commitment to public transportation is second to none.
But the governor's refused to provide details about exactly how she plans to fund the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, or MTA, now that it faces a $15 billion shortfall in its budget that would have been raised by congestion pricing and used to improve accessibility and fund expansions of the city's mass transportation system relied on by low-income residents to work, take their kids to school, and so much more. This week, members of the MTA board are meeting to address service reliability and station accessibility without those funds. Meanwhile, climate advocate Bill McKibben described the governor's abandonment of the program, which would also reduce air pollution and fossil fuel emissions, one of the most aggressive anti-environmental actions ever undertaken by a Democratic governor. The outrage over Hochul's decision spans generations. For more, we're joined by two guests. David Jones is with us. He's an MTA board member, also president and CEO of the Community Service Society of New York, which focuses on the economic advancement and civic participation of low-income New Yorkers. And we're joined by Keanu Arpels Josiah, a climate activist and organizer with Fridays for Future NYC. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! David, let's begin with you. Thank you so much for taking time from this three-day meeting of the MTA board. Can you respond to the governor? She has said that, you know, this just hurts too many people. But what people is she talking about? Who does congestion pricing help? David, we don't hear you. Go ahead.
This may not work.
Yeah, it's working. We can hear you, David. David, we don't hear you. We'll come back to you. Let's go to our next guest, Keanu Arpels Josiah. When you heard the governor speak and cancel this program that she had long advocated for, as had the governor before her and beyond, what was your response?
It was outrage. I mean, this is a program that Governor Hochul, as you mentioned, has spent the past 5 years advocating for, and all of a sudden just weeks away from its implementation, just weeks away of the traffic of the cameras, the toll cameras coming on in Lower Manhattan, she completely reversed it. And that completely fits with the governor's general policy on climate. She's been failing our generation on climate across the board. In her State of the State address back in January, she only spent one sentence of the hour-long address talking about the climate crisis, and that fits with the amount of action her administration has been doing on climate.
You know, we're talking on primary day. This is a primary in Colorado, but also here in New York, very significant. She canceled this just before this primary. But if you can talk about the climate effects, you know, today we wanted to have two generations on, from David Jones, you know, an icon here in New York, to you, Keanu. You just graduated from high school. You're wearing a pin that says climate can't wait. You're for your age, you're going to be 19 tomorrow, a longtime climate activist, which is amazing. What does congestion pricing have to do with the climate?
Yeah, so the climate crisis, as we know, is here and now. As you mentioned, the air quality in New York City is getting worse and worse. And we know that we're at a dire point in the climate crisis. The UN head of climate recently said we have 2 years left to save the world, and that is not exaggeration. In New York City, we're the third biggest emitting city in the world, and 25% of our emissions come from vehicles. So that's what congestion pricing aimed to tackle. It aimed to begin to cut down those emissions. It aimed to begin to actually meet our climate goals. We know we have to reduce emissions by 50% by 2030 here in New York State, and we're far, far below that. So congestion pricing aimed to begin to do that. And with Governor Hochul's cancellation of this program and her failure on climate across the board, she continues to refuse to sign critical climate legislation to make fossil fuel companies pay their fair share, like the Climate Superfund Act. And she's failing our generation across the board. And it really brings us to a moment where one of the biggest blue states in America, New York State, one of the biggest economies in America, is failing on this issue of climate, and my generation is horrified.
Well, we have David Jones on the phone with us right now. David Jones, if you can talk about what this means for the MTA. You're an MTA board member, also president and CEO of Community Service Society. You're talking about billions the MTA is losing. Who would have gained from congestion pricing, David?
Congestion pricing was passed in 2019 by the legislature, signed by the governor at the time, Andy Cuomo. And up until about a week and a half ago, it was about to be implemented at the end of this month. It was going to mean a tremendous boost to the capital needs of the MTA, in not only subways and buses, but the Long Island Railroad and Metro North. And basically, it was only going to capital. So this was going to be state of good repair, as I've said repeatedly, so the wheels don't fall off. But also the Second Avenue subway, something that had been promised to the people of Harlem decades ago. It also was going to mean making accessible, pursuant to numerous lawsuits, ADA accessibility for the handicapped. And all of that now has been put into question. But it also, obviously, as you, your speaker before me mentioned, not going to deal with a congestion that's in the central business district in New York, which leads to trucks, buses, and cars idling for literally hours and spewing out fumes that impact air quality.
Both David and Keanu, I have to confess to you, I have long been a skeptic on the congestion pricing in the decades that it's been proposed in New York City for two reasons I'd like you to respond to. One, Keanu, on the pollution issue, why not just do what Mexico City has done for decades, which is limit cars coming into the metropolitan, into the city by license plate numbers? And Mexico City sharply reduced its pollution as a result of that kind of policy. And David, to you, I respect you immensely, but the MTA is notorious for wasteful spending of billions of dollars on capital projects. How are we to expect that the new revenue from a regressive tax, largely on working class and middle class people, is going to make the MTA more efficient in its use of public dollars?
Yeah. So I'd like to respond to that first, if I can, just on your presumption that the tax is mostly a regressive tax on lower and income, lower and moderate income New Yorkers. It's first of all not a tax, it's a toll, right? And second of all, that is not borne out in the statistics. 55% of workers traveling into the central business district zone, which is what the congestion pricing plan affects, are higher income. 83% are higher or moderate income. So that means if you look at the statistics for how low income New Yorkers are traveling into lower Manhattan, for every one New Yorker who might be traveling via car into the central business district, there are 50 who are waiting for a delayed subway, waiting for a delayed bus. Every New Yorker has a story of waiting for a bus or subway for extreme amounts of time. And the solution to affordability in New York, as the governor has herself been saying for 50 years, is not canceling congestion pricing. It's funding the MTA. It's giving us reliability. It's giving us accessible subway stations. That's really what congestion pricing is about. It's about what future do we want for New Yorkers. Is it one where we have reliable subway? Is it one where we have air that we can breathe without getting asthma? Is it one of climate and environmental justice? Or is it one where we have to wait on hours in gridlock traffic?
Keanu Arpels Josiah, we want to thank you for being with us. That does it for this show, climate activist and organizer with Fridays for Future NYC. And we want to thank David Jones, sorry for the connection problems, MTA board member and president of Community Service Society of New York. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.